Welcome back to the program. Almost every aspect of life today moves at a rapid pace. We struggle to keep up. We're told that to delay is to procrastinate, and that procrastination just might be the cardinal sin of the digital age. But what if delay, be it a few seconds, a few weeks, or more, helps us make better decisions and achieve better outcomes in life, in business, in pursuit of happiness? Just maybe procrastinators know something that we don't. Joining us today to put all of this in a broader perspective is our guest, Frank Partnoy. He's the George E. Barrett Professor of Law and Finance and the Director for the Center for Corporate and Securities Law at the University of San Diego. He's one of the world's leading experts on the complexities of modern finance and financial market regulation. And it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Frank Partnoy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. It seems like much of what you talk about, especially today, is this delicate balance, this kind of dance we do between time on the one hand and technology on the other.
Yes, that's right. And it's gotten much worse for all of us as the crush of technology has speeded up our decisions. Every day we confront all of this barrage of email and social media and 24-hour news, and our hardwiring equips us with a lot of great fight-or-flight responses that worked in the savannah 100,000 years ago and worked reasonably well for us until all of this technology hit. But now it's not serving us so well.
Talk a little bit about where it's not serving us well, because one of the things you distinguish between is kind of conscious and unconscious decision-making.
Yes, and this is one of the aspects of decision-making I hadn't really thought through before I started doing interviews and the research for Wait, and that's that it really does matter how long you have available to make a decision, that our hardwiring is quite different when we confront a milliseconds-long response than it is when we confront a seconds-long or even a minute-long response. And The neuroscientist Benjamin Libet found that there's this 500 millisecond consciousness barrier. So we snap react in all sorts of ways that are potentially dangerous within milliseconds. For example, if I subliminally flash a fast food logo at you, I can make you read 20% faster. Mm-hmm. You won't realize that you've even seen the logo, but you'll read faster. Your experiences with photography and seeing beautiful paintings or music will be interfered with. And all this happens at a kind of pre-conscious level. Our snap reactions based on race and gender all happen very, very quickly. And that's a very different time world than the world of seconds. So one of the things that I try to advocate for people, and I've used myself, is to sort of view decision-making as a two-step process. One is figuring out what time world you're living in, and sometimes that will be a pre-conscious time world that you can't influence consciously while reactions are happening. But then second, once you figure that out, try to work to delay your reactions as long as possible within that time frame.
With respect to the really narrow time world and the 500 milliseconds or less, you talk about this with respect to athletes, particularly baseball players, tennis players, who really understand how to use that time.
That's right. And we think of great baseball players or tennis players as being good because they're so fast. But in fact, studies show they're good because they're so slow, that they're able to use the, say, 450 milliseconds available to return a professional tennis serve or to hit a professional baseball pitch, that they're able to take that 450 milliseconds and stretch it out as long as they possibly can. They perfect their stroke and make their stroke as fast as possible so that they can wait until the last possible moment so that they can process just a little bit more information about the speed and flight and trajectory of the ball. And what the studies show is that the difference between professionals and amateurs is just about 50 milliseconds, just that little bit of extra time that people, some great athletes can get before they hit the ball. And it's extraordinary because this, again, is all pre-conscious. You can't even fathom what 50 milliseconds would be. But that's actually the difference between the pros and the rest of us.
And is this something that comes out of training? Is it intuitive? Is it something that just happens like blink by doing it a lot? What is the mechanism that's at play?
Part of it is nature, and part of it is nurture. So part of it is that some people simply are more gifted at freeing up this extra time. But a lot of it does come from practice and the right kind of practice. And so expertise is really a combination of two things. It's a combination of naturally being good at something. I mean, even if I practiced forever, I would never be able to adequately return a professional tennis serve or a major league fastball. But it's a combination of having a basic hardwired skill set and then repeating the stroke, repeating the action as long as possible so that you develop a kind of intuition. It's true of all sorts of experts. Firefighters, for example, when Gary Klein did his initial studies for the military, instead of focusing on military decision-making, he went and looked at how firefighters make decisions. And it's much the same way. There's a kind of instinctive built-in reaction, but then it's honed by years of practice, by training, by seeing lots of different situations. And for a great firefighter, they show up at the scene and they instinctively know exactly what to do.
But of course, the other side of that, which is something you talk about, is the danger of expertise.
That's right. And the most dangerous situation you can be in is when you think you're an expert, but you're actually a novice, that you believe that you've confronted this sort of situation numerous times before. And this sometimes happens with coaches in particular. I go through the example of the miracle at the Meadowlands and talk about professional coaches who confront this. But one of the most interesting examples, I think, is with chess masters, who we think of as being true experts in their craft. And there's a series of studies done by a neuroscientist at Oxford University called Peter McLeod, and one of the things that he found was that he would set up these chess masters with a move that they knew cold, that they'd seen many, many times, and then show them a move that was somewhat less familiar but that was better. And their expertise with the move they knew cold clouded their ability to see the better move. There's a kind of he calls it the Einstellung effect, this attitude, German for attitude, that we get when we think that we're experts. And that can create a lot of dangers for us, because if you believe you're an expert, you won't take a step back and think through what it is you're doing. You'll think you have all the right answers, but in fact, if the situation has changed a little bit, it might be quite dangerous for you.
Part and parcel of that is this kind of almost anti-procrastination industry that has become built up over time. Talk a little about that.
Yes, and we didn't used to be this way. The Greeks and Romans regarded procrastination as an indication of wisdom, the wise elders who would sit back and think great thoughts and take their time. And we started moving in the wrong direction in the 18th century when Jonathan Edwards gave his famous anti-procrastination sermon. But then, as you say, the real anti-procrastination industry started building up in the 1970s with management theorists like Peter Drucker and David Allen telling us first things first, get things done. And we started to feel very guilty about procrastinating over the next few decades. And one of the things that happened was we started thinking that we're procrastinating much more, even though we're not necessarily. And then the crush of technology entered in the last several years, and we procrastination ran into the teeth of email and social media and 24-hour news. And so now we're in this situation where a lot of us feel like we're procrastinating. We're told we're procrastinating. The culture is that we should feel bad about that. But in fact, the human condition is that we'll always be procrastinating. We always have more things to do at any point in time than we possibly could get done. It's just human nature that we'll always be putting off some of those things. And so the question is really not whether we're procrastinating. We know we'll be procrastinating. The question is, what are our priorities? Are we putting off the right things? If we have a dirty closet or our desk is messy, we might feel guilty about that and think that we're procrastinating. But if our priorities are otherwise, if we're spending the time we might have been cleaning, working productively, or spending time with our family, if we're working on a cure for cancer, why should we feel so guilty about procrastinating cleaning our closet?
Of course, the flip side of that is Lehman Brothers, I suppose.
Right, and there's this extraordinary story I found in the research for Weight about the course that Lehman Brothers designed. This is back in 2005 when the bank was roaring and doing very well, and the president, Joe Gregory, was a smart guy who wanted to try to understand how they could improve their decision-making. He was very much a go-with-your-gut kind of person, though. And so he arranged this course. He brought four dozen of Lehman's top executives to the Palace Hotel on Madison Avenue in New York, and they heard from many of the leading decision-makers. Many psychologists and business school professors came in. This is, again, fall of 2005. Malcolm Gladwell had just written his bestseller, Blink, and so they had Malcolm Gladwell come in and give this capstone lecture, and they studied some of the dangers of snap decisions, but also the benefits of snap decisions, and then they immediately marched across Manhattan back to their headquarters in Times Square and proceeded to make the worst snap decisions in the history of financial markets. And I just thought this was an amazing story, that they were unable to resist their own urges to snap react. And, of course, Wall Street has had this problem for a long time. We see it most recently with high-frequency trading, and many of us are selling and buying stocks much, much too frequently. There's this ongoing epidemic of day trading. And so one of the things I wanted to do with Wait was to gather recent research and try to help people understand how in all kinds of decisions, but particularly for people in investing, in their personal investing, but also on Wall Street, how we'd be better off waiting, how we'd be better off delaying, stepping back, maybe even changing the nature of the trading day. When I worked in Tokyo for Morgan Stanley, we had a lunch break. We would take some time off. There would be no trading at various times during the day, and I think we've gotten into a very dangerous situation constantly looking at trading screens at milliseconds-long changes in stock prices. That can't be good for long-term growth or for sustainability.
With respect to the high-frequency trading, you tell the story about even that had to slow down in order to go faster.
These high-frequency traders are very smart, and so I tell the story of this firm called UNX that set up new computers in Burbank, California, just a couple blocks east of Interstate 5, and they had been a very, very poor performing firm, and they brought in a new CEO who set up these new computers and created new algorithms and flipped the switch in Burbank and found that they suddenly were among the very, very best performing firms in the world. And the engineers came in and said, well, you know what, faster is always better, right? The first mouse gets the cheese, and it's taking us, even at the speed of light, it's taking our signals about 30 to 35 milliseconds to get from Burbank, California to New York, where the trades are executed on the New York Stock Exchange. So let's move all the computers, let's pack them up and ship them to New York, and we'll get faster, and so we'll get better. The total time of the algorithm was about 65 milliseconds, so they said, hey, we can cut it in half. So they pack up their computers and they ship them to New York, and they flip them on again, and they find that now their execution is terrible. They're back at the bottom of the performance, and no one can figure out why. And their new Renaissance guy, CEO Scott Harrison, has the idea of just telling the computers to slow down a little bit, telling them, hey, just step back, procrastinate at the speed of light. Wait an extra 30 milliseconds. And so they instruct the computers to do that, and their performance skyrockets. And one of the things that they found, which was incredible to me, but is known in the high-frequency trading world, is that there's an optimal amount of delay, that sometimes the first mouse doesn't get the cheese. If there's a dangerous cat that's hungry, the first mouse gets eaten, and the second mouse gets the cheese. And so what a lot of high-frequency trading firms are doing is really battling with each other and faking each other out in the first few milliseconds, and the algorithms that don't react instantaneously to those fake-out moves, it's sort of like a fencing match, that if you can sit back and wait, in this case, just a few extra milliseconds, that you'll actually perform better. So I found it was extraordinary that, like the world of professional athletes, this world of milliseconds gives us some instruction, a model, actually, for us to use in our much longer-term decision-making.
And in a broader sense, that's kind of a metaphor for the bigger issues that say that there isn't always a first-mover advantage.
Yes, and there's a lot of research that shows that, in fact, there's often a second-mover advantage, that there's a first-mover disadvantage, and that you're you're better off delaying. And this is true of all kinds of aspects of our personal lives, that for dates, for apologies, that we often snap react, but in fact we'd be better off delaying. The research on apologies shows, for example, something quite counterintuitive, which is that although we're taught as kids that we should apologize right away, and sometimes we should, if you just accidentally spill a drink on someone, you should apologize right away because it's unintentional and it's a simple act. But for intentional, complicated acts, if you wrong your partner or someone at work, that the best, most effective apologies are delayed as long as possible.
And why is that?
Well, there are really two reasons why. One is that if you apologize right away, the other person doesn't have time to process information about exactly what you did. They don't find out the who, what, where, when, why, the details of who, what happened. And so the apology doesn't mean as much because they haven't learned all this information. And the second reason is that if you apologize right away, they don't have time to vent. They don't have time to yell at you to make their views known. So that if you snap apologize, if you apologize right away, you won't have gotten into the other person's shoes. They you know what went wrong. You understand the emotional impact of it, but they don't yet. And so this is what studies have confirmed, is that if you can delay the apology as long as you possibly can, again, it's this two-step process. First, figure out what time world you're living in. For an apology, it might be a few hours, it might be a day, it might be a week. And then second, procrastinate, wait as long as possible. And if you can do that with an apology, then the other person will have a chance to really understand what it is that happened, to know all of the details first, and then second, to have a time to express themselves. And so if you want to apologize and apologize effectively, it's better to wait as long as possible. One of the things that I do in wait is go through apologies by politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Politicians are not very good at apologizing. They often apologize much too quickly, and I have a kind of a politician sexual transgression apology playbook that goes from Anthony Weiner to Bill Clinton to, you know, various politicians and media stars and actors and comedians are the same way. Tracy Morgan,
mm-hmm,
versus Mel Gibson, people might remember their respective apologies. And one of the things that comes out of the study of apologies is that we're often better off delaying.
Basically, it's what the military would call strategy.
It's exactly right, that we live in a world in which we do too much tactical work and don't do enough strategically. And in fact, the military is really a source of great wisdom on this. I spend a lot of time in Wait talking about John Boyd, who many people think is the greatest jet fighter pilot of all time. And he had a theory about this, about strategy. And what was interesting about his theory is that it works at different time scales. We often think about strategy as being something that takes years, that's very long term. But Boyd created a decision-making framework called OODA, O-O-D-A, for observe, orient, decide, and act. And his idea was that what people should do in a dogfight or in all kinds of military decisions is run through those steps, observe, sort of like a tennis player observes, take in information about the ball coming in, take in information about your enemy, how is that plane moving in front of you, orient, second, position yourself effectively, figure out where your opponent's weaknesses are, decide, make the decision about what you're going to do. Are you going to flick to the right or flick to the left, or what kind of turn and when to fire? And then act at the end. Take your action, whatever it is. And Boyd also had an intriguing idea of what he called the OODA loop, of cycling through this process over and over again. And it's very interesting how something like this strategy for a dogfight might work effectively for all kinds of other decisions. And actually, I think one of the things that I compared Boyd's OODA loop to was dating, that the process that people follow in a first date is actually very similar to OODA, to observe, orient, decide, and act.
The other reason for delay sometimes is that there are simply no good options available, and the situation on the ground will change.
It will, and we all know, we all can recall the email we responded to too quickly or the work task we did right away, and then the world changed and it turns out we did the wrong thing or we didn't need to do anything at all. If we had just waited, the job would have gone away. I interviewed a lot of CEOs and senior political leaders, and they're all very good at understanding that, at seeing something that other people might view as a crisis and just sitting back and doing nothing. A couple of people mentioned something they'd heard from Lynn Nofziger, the political strategist and regulator, that he recommended that people, if you take everything in your inbox — this was back before email inboxes, your actual inbox — if you take everything in your inbox and simply move it to your outbox, that you'll have done the right thing 99% of the time. And the reason for that is exactly what you say, that although we think that all these tasks that are being pushed on us are tasks that need to be completed right away, that often if we just put them off for a little while, there'll be some intervening event. Something will happen and we won't have had to do it.
It's true for the way in which we react to things as well, because a lot of the things that we react to that make us angry or make us need to jump through hoops right away are really about things that are never going to materialize or never going to happen.
I think that's absolutely right. And we have this hardwiring, which, again, was very effective when we're out on the savannah and we need to react instantaneously to a threat or an opportunity for food. But that isn't necessarily the way that we optimize decision-making in the modern world. And the fact that we're confronted with this crush of technology leads us to react when often we'd be better off just sitting back and letting time pass.
The other part, the corollary to that, is Donald Rumsfeld used to talk about the idea that if you have a problem that has no solution or an intractable problem, the solution sometimes is to create a bigger problem.
You know, there's a lot, and there actually are several advisors about procrastination who say that you should do exactly that, that if you are facing a bunch of tasks that you can't seem to get done or that you feel bad about, that what you should do is find some other tasks that you know you'll never get done, that you know you'll procrastinate. John Perry, a philosopher at Stanford, has this idea of structured procrastination. And what he suggests that you do is make a list of the things that you need to do as you might normally. Here are the tasks I need to perform. And then at the top of the list, leave space for two or three huge, huge items that you know you'll never get done. So writing the great American novel or a radical remodel of your apartment or house. And put those at the very top of the list, and you'll procrastinate those. You know, it's sort of about fooling yourself in the same way Rumsfeld maybe was suggesting, but that you know you'll procrastinate those, and in some sense that will fill up your need to procrastinate, and then you have to do something, right? No one advocates that you should just lie around on the sofa, right? So you have to do something. So you move down your list and you say, oh, well, actually, I have these tasks that I need to do, so I'll just do those.
The other part of it comes back to the dog that's on the cover of your book, which is this notion of delayed gratification and the importance of understanding it even from childhood.
Yes, and the dog on the cover is a golden retriever that has a bone perched precariously on its snout, and it's a role model for us, showing how she is able to delay gratification and not eat the bone right away. And delayed gratification is a great predictor of emotional success later in life. There are the famous marshmallow experiments that Walter Mischel did, where he took a group of four-year-olds and tested whether they could wait 15 minutes for a second marshmallow. He presented them with one marshmallow and said, would you rather have this one, you can eat it right now, or if you wait 15 minutes, you can have a second one. And it was an amusing study at the time, and there's some videos available on the web where you can watch kids trying to distract themselves for 15 minutes so they can get a second marshmallow. But one of the amazing things that came out of the study was that the ability to delay gratification is associated later in life. These kids were studied 14 years later, and then later than that. It's associated with higher standardized test scores, better marriages, higher incomes, less obesity, and greater mental health, better mental health. One of the astonishing things that I found in the research for weight was that a lot of the reason for that, for our ability to sort of monitor ourselves, goes to infinitesimal milliseconds long changes in our heart rates. That some children are able to regulate their heart rates, sort of like a high performance car would be able to speed up and slow down, and that the ability to regulate your heart rate in the range of milliseconds is a strong predictor of future mental health, in the same way cholesterol or blood pressure is an indication of physical health. And so for all of us, if we're, I have two kids, we're thinking about how the next generation will confront all this stimulus, all this technology. One of the most important things to focus on is the ability to delay gratification. How are kids able to put off grabbing that marshmallow? That we have this interesting new measure, which is their heart rate variability, to test and to look at. It turns out that heart rate variability is associated with all kinds of disorders, ranging from asthma to autism, potentially, to borderline personality disorder. So there's a kind of new vanguard in science to study this idea of delayed gratification. But it is the thing that distinguishes us from animals. The dog on the cover is doing pretty well, but we as human beings, if you think about what distinguishes us from animals, it's really our ability to think about the future, and that means the ability to delay gratification for even longer than a dog.
Frank Partnoy, the book is Weight, The Art and Science of Delay. Frank, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.